We are welcoming a new show to iHeart and the DraftKings YouTube channel. It is called Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano. It is an insider look at the NBA and the coaches surrounding the league. Every week, the five-time All-Star and the number one pick in the 2010 NBA Draft, John Wall, will give his unique perspective on hot topics in the league and tell the best behind-the-scenes stories from his time in the NBA. So check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, the DraftKings YouTube channel, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Don't miss the new docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History from Onyx Collective and Hulu. Based on the Wired cover story by Jason Parham and directed by Princess Penny, executive producer of Insecure, Black Twitter, A People's History tells the story of how black voices found a new home online and blossomed into a force for change, while laying down some hilarious tweets along the way. If you were there for Meet Me in Temecula or Thanksgiving Clapback, you need to see this series. If you weren't there, time to dive in. Watch how Black Lives Matter grew and gained force because of the voices on Black Twitter, bringing these issues to the forefront like never before. From the memes to the movements, see how this powerful community shapes culture, society, and politics. Black Twitter, A People's History, is now streaming on Hulu.
State Farm Insurance knows that understanding and investing in our cultural identity is paramount in protecting our future. We know what it's like to go from nothing to something, to wish that we had better financial literacy when we were younger. Luckily, State Farm is here to help with funding programs like Project Ready, which is committed to education achievement and has already awarded over $11 million in scholarship offers to Black and Brown youth since 2021. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
If you're looking for the most epic place on Earth, let's start at the base of a massive waterfall. Then trek through the thick jungle. Then climb to the peak of a snowy mountaintop. Then once you get there, keep going. Because with intelligent 4x4 and 7 drive modes and a Nissan Pathfinder, the search is the real adventure.
Available feature. Intelligent 4x4 cannot prevent collisions or provide enhanced traction in all conditions. Always monitor traffic and weather conditions.
AT&T connects an ode to podcast. Connect the alarm, change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze, 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower, lather up with the news, sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work and traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories, change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
What up, y'all? It's DJ Envy, and tournament time is officially here. So fill out your brackets and place your bets on who you think will rise to the top with my partners at DraftKings Sportsbook. Right now, all new customers who bet $5 will get $150 in bonus bets instantly. Download the DraftKings app now and sign up using my code TBC. The crown is yours. That's right. New customers can bet $5 on anything and receive $150 in bonus bets instantly. Stay in on the action and use your $150 bonus bets on DraftKings same game parlays for a shot at an even bigger payout. Combined with multiple bets together from the same game, including total points scored, number of rebounds by your favorite player, and more. If sports betting is not in your state, don't worry. You can still join in on the fun with DraftKings Daily Fantasy and have a shot at cash prizes as well.
Wake that ass up early in the morning.
The Breakfast Club.
Morning, everybody. It's DJ Envy, Jess Hilarious, Charlamagne Tha God. We are the Breakfast Club. We got a special guest in the building.
The fucking legend, man.
Bill Burr. Welcome.
Hey.
Hello. How you feeling?
I'm all right.
You all right?
Yeah. When you hear the word legend, do you just feel old or you feel like I'm accomplished?
I don't know what I feel. I never feel like this business is. You feel like, you know, any moment, like whatever you got is going to go away. So I don't pay attention to that stuff. Mm-hmm. I obviously like it. No, legend doesn't make me feel old. It makes me feel good. But when somebody's like, man, I grew up on your comedy.
Yeah.
I started listening to you when I was 8. I'm like, oh my God, and you're seeing they're like, you know, divorced. Yeah. You're like, oh God, how old am I? So yeah, I would say that's the type of stuff that makes me feel old.
I want to go back a little bit, if you don't mind.
Okay.
I want to know, you know, what got Bill Burr into comedy?
Dramatic childhood.
Was it
sorry, nobody, you on nobody happy gets into this stuff. Just, and then the delusions of fame get into your head, and then you somehow get into it. No, I mean, I definitely liked it when I was growing up, but I got into it by chance where, you know, I'm old, man, so, like, I was watching it in the 70s and 80s, but, like, show business was like, it was a million miles away. Mm-hmm. It was impossible. It was not something that you could do, right. Like, you know, just take out a camera and start filming yourself. So
I grew up
in Massachusetts.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Suburb. So I thought, like, you know, you had to be in Hollywood to get into it. Like, mm-hmm. I had no idea there was this huge stand-up scene in Massachusetts. So I was working in a warehouse, and I was working with this guy, and he was into stand-up the way I was, and he was funny as hell. And one night we used to go over to his house, have a couple of beers before we went out, you know, save some money. And we were watching stand-up, and he was going, Bill, we're funnier than these guys. Like, and, you know, he goes, one night I'm going to take a shot at Jack Daniels and go up on stage. And that's when it stopped being on TV, and it was next to me, and I started thinking, like, oh, wait a minute, if he can try it, I can try it. Hmm. And still took me another 5 years to figure it out. I started kind of late.
Did you ever feel like you had to wear a dress and suck a cock to get on in Hollywood?
Jesus Christ. No, and that whole theory is ridiculous. Yeah. That's what's going on out there, yeah. That there's more pedophiles in Hollywood than there are in plumbing. It's a problem.
Why plumbing?
I don't know. Just like regular jobs. They're acting like every pedophile in jail, like, created, you know, friggin', you
Star
know.
Wars franchise.
Star Wars,
or something.
Yeah, it's yeah, like, yeah. No, it's like, they're like, they're going, that's what's going on. What's funny is what's going on in Hollywood is going on in most businesses, where it's like, there's a lot of people working overtime, not getting paid, mm-hmm. not getting credit, and getting pushed down, and people at the top taking more and more. But the problem with Hollywood is those idiots stay in Hollywood, and they look at most of the country like flyover states,
right.
And then they go on these stupid, you know, award shows, and they talk down to them.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And
mm-hmm.
then that makes them hate them, and then they love to see somebody going down. The whole thing is, it's like traveling is depressing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because what you find is everybody really is the same. Like, all of this That's stuff, right. like, you know, all these people are evildoers, and they're this and that. And you go over there, and it's just everybody's the same. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody, you know, wants to have money to have a sandwich. You want to find love. Mm-hmm. You want to feel safe.
Yeah.
That's, everybody is like that. But then they just, you know, the sociopaths get the dumb people wound up.
I feel like New York and L.A. have no idea what the rest of the country is actually like. If you grew up in New York or you grew up in L.A., you don't know what the real world is like.
Dude, New Yorkers are some of the worst traveled people you're ever going to meet. Mm-hmm. They're hilarious. Everywhere they go. They would go to Guam and be like, oh, I go to Guam. I try to get a bacon, egg, and cheese. And the lady's looking at me like, what are you talking about? This place sucks. Where are the skyscrapers? Like, that's what cracks you about New York is that they're like, it's like the point of traveling is to get something different. Mm-hmm. Like, they go to L.A. and they try to get a bacon, egg, and cheese. It's like, get a taco. What are you doing?
When in Rome, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't come here and try to get a burrito. I've seen Mexican foods here. I just start laughing. It's like, no, I'm not doing that.
The closest we usually got is Taco Bell. That's usually what New York has.
I love that you said that because Mexicans all think that white people think Taco Bell is authentic Mexican food. It's like, we're not that dumb.
That is crazy. No, that is so dumb.
Mm-hmm. I know Olive Garden is not Italian.
Italian, correct.
Yes,
correct.
I understand that they have hoarded out.
Mm-hmm. What did Bill Burr want to be before he became a comedian? You just always wanted to do comedy?
I was just failing at everything. Mm-hmm. I did horrible in school. I did good in school until it mattered. It was weird. I did really good right up till eighth grade, and then once college started paying attention, I don't know. I just, that's, you know, I'm not going to get into it, but that's when all like the ass hit the fan with a lot of stuff. So then, I don't know what. I tried construction. I wasn't good at that. Mm-hmm. Landscaping. I worked in warehouses. I knew I didn't want a boss, mm-hmm. and I also knew that I didn't want to go into the same building for more than a year. Because a few times I had jobs for over a year, and there was just something so depressing because you were working for somebody else's dream, and it was like a year earlier, I was standing right here. I have not moved anywhere. Mm. I'm another year older.
Bill, you got me depressed now. I've been here for 15 years.
Yeah, but I wasn't sitting in a throne.
Okay.
I was unloading trucks.
This guy's drinking from a chalice. Like, oh, I feel good about this. My scented candle.
No, I wasn't. We were like unloading trucks and getting hammered and driving drunk, stuff you did in the 80s. I mean, that was basically what it was. So, and I was going part-time to college because I didn't have money to go to college. So I was paying my own way through it. And I had already stayed back in first grade. So I just felt like hopelessly behind until I started hanging out, you know, with people that were into comedy. And then somehow I found it. And yeah, then I remember doing that. And then I was just like, all right, this is what I'm supposed to do. Because everything else I was doing, I just never felt... I always never felt like this is not it. I don't feel like these people aren't the same kind of weird that I am, you know?
Why do you think you're weird, though?
I mean, like, I think we're all, like, messed up a little bit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why do I think I'm weird? I don't know. If I knew why I was weird, I wouldn't be weird, I think.
I think you got a lot of common sense. Yeah. Whenever I hear you speak, I'm like, this guy is just, he's just a common sense human being.
Well, I've learned from a lot of failures.
Yeah. Your own or others?
Oh, my own.
Okay.
Oh, and also others. Well, that, you know, I had a great education when I got in to stand up. The big 80s. I don't know how old you guys are, but the big
80s. I'm 45. Okay. Born in 1978.
Okay, so the big 80s boom, where stand up comedy clubs exploded and all that, and then it just got to the point you could just put like a microphone anywhere, and people would show up for comedy. So the quality of it went down. And everybody was doing, well, a lot of people were doing blow, getting paid in cash and in blow and all of that type of stuff. And then it all came crashing down. And then the IRS showed up and everything. And then I started. Like, I walked in, like, you know, the end of the party. Balloons were on the ground, confetti, everybody passed out. And I saw all these headliners that were getting their wages garnished. And they had to talk to the IRS to go do some, you know, funny bone in another state and everything. So my generation kind of learned, like, all right, man, you can party this away in about 7-8 crucial years. So I learned from that. And then, you know, any young comics watching this, your 20s and 30s are difficult because you're struggling. And then also you do that comparison thing. Like, well, you started the same time I did and you're here and I'm here. So I must be doing something wrong. And then I start hating you for some stupid reason. Mm-hmm. And then, like, that takes up a lot of energy. And then one day you just basically figure out, like, all right, I'm making the decisions here. I'm doing well or not doing well by what I'm thinking rather than this other stuff.
Did you ever want to quit?
Once. When? No, one time I thought I wasn't going to make it. It was the only time I ever thought it.
When was this?
You bombed?
No. Mm-hmm. No, that happened all the time. That's just part of this stuff. Yeah. I was doing the, I'm not going to say where I was because it's a sad story. I'm going to bum you out.
Okay.
So I was doing this club that I had just been going to for years and years and years and years and years. Every other year I'd go there. New Hour. Going to get them. You know, I'm in with the morning radio guys. And the same 30 people were showing up. Mm-hmm. So it was after the late show. And I was sitting there, you know, reeking of smoke because you could smoke all three shows. Smelled like I fought a fire. My eyes were all burning. Mm-hmm. And I was just looking at the wait staff, and they were lifers. They had been there before, and they were older, a little bit heavier, and they were counting up their money, and they were smoking their cigarettes, and the same amount of people had showed up. And that was the first time I like, this thought went in my head, like, of like, wait a minute. Am I the guy who doesn't make it? Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. The panic of that. I went back to the comedy condo, and I was just laying in bed trying to turn it around. And my brain was just, no, you're the guy who's not going to make it. So that was, yeah. Then I got back to New York, and it was better. You know, I came, you know, after the gig, I came back, and then just like the energy, I had a couple of good sets. You know, Sunday night at the Boston Comedy Club was a huge turning point for me in my career. Probably how I ended up here right now. Mm-hmm. And that would get me to think positive.
And you said you never bombed, right? And
I didn't say you have bombed all the time.
You have, but I don't think you bombed, Bill. I think that people don't know if they should laugh at what you're saying. You know what I mean?
Well, maybe now, but no. Back then, you just... Oh, I remember bombing so bad one time. There's this comedy club called Mixed Nuts that's now called the Comedy Union. And that was the black club, right? So I went down there, and it's funny. I started doing those rooms because I used to listen to Richard Pryor. So, like... Mm-hmm. His albums were so live that you could, like, picture the crowd. So I had this idea of what a crowd looked like. It was weird. I'm white as hell, and that was my idea of what a crowd was. So ended up doing those rooms along with the white rooms, right? So I was on stage bombing so bad. Like this right here, silence. And I just remember hearing this woman's voice in the back. She just goes, "I ain't laughed yet." About 10 minutes.
Damn.
And then that was the biggest laugh of the set. Everybody laughed, and then they just started talking amongst themselves. And I didn't know how to turn it around. It was, and there's something, it's bad enough bombing in front of your own people, but bombing in front of another race of people, knowing that you're taking down a bunch of other white comics with you.
Because you represent for all white
everybody.
Comics.
It's just I'm white people ain't funny. This corny ass motherfucker. Man. It's not just me. There are others out there. They're funny. Yeah. It was bad.
You liked Richard Pryor. What's your favorite Richard Pryor album?
Maybe was it something I said? The one I can't say.
The one came out in 82.
Half of them have the N word in it. You're going to get me in trouble. Half of them.
That was a setup question, I think.
I'm lucky I got a good night's sleep. I would have been like, I like that N word's crazy. I will say I bought his albums because he just looked funny. That was the first one I bought. That N word's crazy when he was pointing like that. He just looked funny. And that's how I bought the first Eddie Murphy up. I bought the first Eddie Murphy album because I was like, well, he's also black. He must be funny. Mm-hmm. And that was the first one we had the rose in his ear.
You see how that works? So you did represent for all white comics because you see one funny black comic.
That's how it works. It's almost like I found a genre of music. So I would listen to, I listened to all of his stuff and I just, there was something about the way he did it. Which I didn't understand it as a kid, but the way he did it, the way he trashed white people, he got you to listen to him and laugh at yourself. Mm-hmm. Where I think by the time Def Jam came around, crack 80s and all of that, like where black comedy was, it was like, all right, I'm not, enough of this like sort of pussyfooting around, mm-hmm. So then it was more like, it was like a different thing. But like what I loved about Richard was like you like rooted for him. You felt like you knew him. It was really insane. I think he's the greatest of all time, and I think it's even close.
During that time, during that era when it seems like that crack time where Def Comedy Jam and the comedy shows, was it hard for you to book in those black rooms? It was like, here comes the white comedian again.
No. That was the irony. It was hard for them.
And you
had
book you?
Yeah, you had to like vouch for him and everything. Mm-hmm. And the club owner's right in front of him. Yeah, you don't do that Def Jam stuff, do you? You're not like MFing. Talking about, I don't know what I can say on the show.
Pussy.
You're not. Oh wait, you said sucking dick earlier. What am I thinking?
I set the tone.
I think that was a personal combo. I don't know.
So they would literally say that, and that was embarrassing. When you'd be standing there going like, egh. But what they you'd come on. They didn't. They would just say, yeah, go up, do your thing, and I felt like guys like. All of those guys I worked for, Talent, Drew Frazier.
Oh, yeah.
Rob Stapleton.
Capone.
Gerald Kelly. Capone. Mm-hmm. All the New York Kings. Mm-hmm. I used to do all of those rooms. And, those are all the memories of that one. I remember Gerald Kelly had a room. Oh, God, that was a brutal room. It was somewhere in, like, Newark in, like, the 2000s. And I remember that. I remember this comedian. Was it Roz G or something? Rest Her Soul. She was on stage and she's super loud. Mm-hmm. And she was super loud and they weren't laughing at anything. And she ended her stage. She's like, God damn. She's like, I don't know who's coming up next, but he better be funny because you motherfuckers ain't laughing at shit. And then she brought me up.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bill Burr.
Did that get a laugh at least?
No.
Oh.
Damn. Well, you know what's weird? I went up. Had an okay set, and I felt like I bombed at anything, and randomly Chris Webber was there. Mm-hmm. And he came up, and he told me I was funny. And it was little things like that. Mm-hmm. Cause I'm like, well, this guy's famous. This guy's successful. He thinks I'm funny, so I think I'll be all right.
Do you change your set when you're doing black rooms versus white rooms?
I try not to. Mm-hmm. Early on, I did. I'd be on stage, and all of a sudden, I'd hear myself tagging all my jokes with, you know what I'm saying? And I'd be like, why am I doing that? Why am I doing that? Stop doing that. But you just would. And then there's an easy way to get through those rooms. You can just be like, I'm the white guy and I'm scared. And that's sort of how you do it initially just to get your feet wet in those rooms. And then basically then it becomes like, now can I actually go up here and talk about what I want to talk about? Wear a Bruins t-shirt, you know, hockey t-shirt or whatever. I started experimenting with that. And I remember Patrice giving me, rest his soul.
Patrice O'Neill.
Yeah, going like, Bill's trying to do his white shit in these black rooms. So sometimes it worked. Sometimes it all depended on the crowd. It all depended on the crowd. But I felt like it's a weird thing where I feel like it's harder to be a black comic in a black room than it is to be a black comic in a white room and vice versa. Because you can just play fish out of water.
Yeah.
Like, oh, wow, this is all different. Gee Louise, you know, I'm all nervous up here. And just literally play into the stereotype. That's the easy laugh.
I guess a little hacky, though.
100%.
Yeah.
Not, but not early on. Okay. I forgive any of it because you're just trying to survive because it's like, you know, that's like not something like white people don't experience being the only you a lot. You know, we just sort of walk in, oh, more white shit, you know, and you just live that. So to first experience that. And that's what's funny. When I first started doing those rooms, I didn't see black people as individuals. I just saw black people. And as I kept doing them, I started to see individuals. Like, oh, this guy's like my buddy Mitch. This guy's like, you know, and I started to see, oh, this guy's a good guy. This guy's a piece of shit. This guy steals jokes. This guy's, you know, and it's like, oh, this is just like white people.
I was going to ask, you know, back in the day, when you named some of those comedians from Talent to Capone, it seems like comedy had a brotherhood. Like, y'all all F with each other. Now it doesn't seem like that, especially with Cat Williams throwing missiles at everybody. Was it a brotherhood back then, or was it always competition and missiles?
No,
throwing?
It always was. It's just you couldn't. You couldn't air your grievances on social media and that type of stuff. Like, no, there still is like a comrade, especially the people that you, like you start out with when you go up and you're doing like open mics and stuff. It's just one impossible situation after another, and you just get thrown into these things, and you sort of bond with each other through just, you know. I mean, I did gigs like. We don't have a microphone. Is that going to be a problem? We're just going to have you stand here in this hall? Oh, my God. No, it was just like some of the stuff, some of the places. And then you would just, what kept you going was your friend in the crowd laughing at you, watching you trying to figure this situation out. So there's definitely that. But, you know, people focus on the negative or whatever. So, I mean, generally speaking, we get along. It's no more difference than other stuff.
Now when you see the black comedians going back and forth with each other, what do you think about that? Do you even look at it as black comedians, or you just look at it as comedians?
No, comedians, because white comedians are doing it too.
Really?
Yeah.
Y'all club Shay Shay? What's y'all club Shay Shay?
Oh, you know, I don't know, because I'm old, but like, yeah, there's definitely, you know, I'm an old school guy where I look at all that stuff like that's locker room stuff. And if you have a problem with somebody, you should go to them and say it. That's how I came up. And then also, like, you know, this business is difficult. I don't need to make it any more difficult. There's people I like, people maybe I don't like, but I don't need to walk around. Like, what good does that do me to do that? But that's me. So, you know, other people do it differently.
Have you ever heard that somebody didn't like you for a reason? Any particular reason?
Yeah, people thought I was a dick. They thought I was like aloof because when I first started, they thought I was like, you know, if you're quiet and you're actually doing well, people get in their head and they thought, oh, he's not talking to me because he doesn't like me. And it wasn't. I was like a mess. I was questioning everything that I had done in the previous 5 minutes. But some people took it like he's not talking to me because he doesn't think I'm funny. So I definitely had a few of those. And I was also an angry guy, so I probably, yeah.
Yeah.
What were you angry about?
Oh, Jesus. Just stuff I don't want to get into.
Okay.
Just stuff that makes you be a comedian.
Yeah.
The usual. I have the you want to talk about hacky? I have all of the hacky background you need to get into this business. So, you know, I could have had a much simpler life.
I think a lot of us, I mean, I deal with, you know, anxiety on a high level. You know what I mean? I think a lot of people do. But I think most people who have a high level of self-awareness really do, because we're just aware that we're dealing with something that we're willing to acknowledge and other people aren't.
Yeah, I mean, every time I think I'm getting sane, I don't know, something else happens. And like, you know, like having kids and stuff really, you know, it really holds a mirror.
My daughter said the cutest thing to me the other day. She goes, Dad, can you stop being mad now? Mm-hmm. And I just bursted out laughing. I was like, yeah, all right. All right. Mm-hmm. That's cool. Mm-hmm. But the way I came up, I would never say that to my dad. Mm-hmm. So I do feel like I've done. What I do like about my kids is that they're not afraid of me at mm-hmm. all. They treat me like a friggin' bouncy house. But I've tried to. You know, I've tried to undo some things.
Yeah, they're not afraid of you because you're probably raising them with love. At least my dad, he raised me with fear, I believe. He was afraid that I would make the same mistakes he made.
Oh, everyone was afraid of that. You were afraid of other people's dads when I was growing up because they could hit you.
Yeah.
You know? So, like, and they had big cars, and they were always mad, yeah. And they were coming home, and you just saw, like, you know, like their wife scampering back into the house, you know, as they were pulling into the driveway. Yeah, men were scary when I was growing up, so mm-hmm. I probably overcorrected mm-hmm. or whatever, but I'd rather have them coming up this way. Yeah, my kids are loud, you know? We were not loud. Like, we were loud when Mom was home. When Dad was home, everybody just shut the hell up, and when he left, it was like, like a stack of bricks off your chest.
Yeah, wait until your dad got home. Oh, my God. Mm-mm. Those were some...
Yeah, you know what's funny? He actually was a big softie. Was also... It turns out that way. My mother was the one that beat us.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We deserved it.
You said earlier you always feel like things would be taken away from you. Like, is that something from childhood or is that cancel culture? Like, what do you mean when you say that?
No, this is before cancel culture. Well, because you would see guys like idiots would get a show on the air and then immediately go buy a big house and a car. But back in the day, they would say you got to wait till the third season so you know that it's rolling. Mm-hmm. And you would watch guys blow all their money. I watched people get deals up at Montreal and they put it all in the .com stock market. I knew that was... I stayed away from that shit. When I was at the comic strip... And comedians stopped talking about comedy, and they were talking about stocks going like, you know, it's going to split again. It's definitely going to split again. I'm like, you are a dummy. Mm-hmm. You're a dummy. I'm a dummy. We should not be talking about this shit. So I didn't put it in, but I saw guys lose all their money that way. there was guys I used to be, you know, looking up like, oh, my God, how do you get to that level? And then their stuff starts to go like that. Mm-hmm. Like this business it's not for the weak, and you got to save your money. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm trying to come with something positive here. It's a fun job, though. It's a fun job.
This is a callback, but when you saw those white comics on that level, did you say to yourself, he sucked a dick to get there? Or did he wear a dress to get there? Like, where does that...
What is that? What is that theory?
Where does that stigma come from?
I'm asking you. You brought that up twice.
Oh, yeah, because that's the stigma. Like, you know, the stigma is, for black comics, you got to wear a dress to get to a certain level. Or, you know,
who did that?
Shit. According to Cat Williams, about 20 people.
Well, hit to Milton Berle. Milton Berle made a whole career, that comes from vaudeville.
Robin Williams, yeah.
Yeah, he played Mrs. Doubtfire. Tom Hanks was on Bosom Buddies.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It was just like, it was kind of we don't have a good idea. Let's put a guy in a dress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what it was, but I understand... You know, that's just one of those white things where I don't have to look at it like, oh, they're doing this because they're trying to belittle me because they don't see me as human. I don't have to deal with all the stuff you guys got to deal with. So, yeah. Like, I don't know if it's how much of that's true, how much of it's paranoia. I mean, I can't speak on that. I have no idea. But, like, you know, I don't.
You never wore a dress.
Yeah, and that whole sucking a dick thing, yeah. Like it's like...
Or
yeah,
just being gay in Hollywood.
No, you just sort of... No, you did...
I said you never wear a dress. He said, nah, not that or that whole sucking a dick thing. That's just right.
No, it's more like you create a show, you go in, you pitch it to these people, mm-hmm. They somehow take control of it, you lose the creative by credit, they make all the money, you don't. That's the way it usually works. It's not like... You want a TV show, huh? All right. Crawl under my desk. Like, and you better do it good because I got another 40 guys waiting to suck this dick. Right. It's like, that's just... I think a lot of people want it to be that way.
Yeah.
Because it just makes them feel better about mm-hmm. their lives and where the fuck they're at. But it's just like, yeah, like most of Hollywood is overworked, underpaid people, not getting credit for some shit that they created. And it happens to everybody. Mm-hmm. It happens at different levels. And you have to learn how to protect yourself, and nobody teaches you. You just go in there taking punches, and then you go, oh, you know, and that's usually how you learn.
unless there's a comic that kind of takes you under his wing or something and teaches you, like, look out for this. They're going to try to do that. Damon Wayans was great at that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, word. I've heard that before.
He was great at that. Like, he barely knew me. And he came, you know, and he said, hey, I saw you on TV. You were funny, man. We stand out in front of the cellar. He goes, what do you got going on? And he just stood there. Damon Wayans. I couldn't believe it. He just stood there and for like 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And he's going, all right. This is what they're going to try to do. And he just, I was going like, oh, my God. I know I just did this business was so ruthless, but I never forgot that. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I learned. It's like, all right, so if I get somewhere, like my job's to tell the younger kids, you know, how they're going to try to come in. That's how they fuck you.
Yeah. Mm.
They don't care about it. They can get a hooker anytime they want or whatever the hell they want. They're trying to take your ideas and get the money. They got all kinds of stuff. They have like, you remember back in the day, there was like points on a show, how many points you had.
Yeah.
And they had literally invented points that didn't mean shit. So you got 40 points. I only got 30, but mine means something. Yours don't mean anything. It's the whole thing is, like, here's one for you. It's way harder to prove somebody stole from you than defamation of character. Mm-hmm. Figure that one out. So that basically protects the thieves. So when somebody steals from you, I can't then go around town and say, this guy stole from me, stay away from him, blah, blah. If that gets back to him, he can sue me, and he can just come up with the phony cost report. Well, this mouse was $30,000, and this was $15,000, and whittle down what he stole, and they get away with it.
Mm.
Wow. Had that experience.
Will it ever be fair? Will there ever be...
No, because human beings are completely flawed, and it's God's fault, because that's how he makes us.
Damn.
So you need to stop going on Sunday praising him. You need constructive criticism.
Missed out, man.
Jesus Christ.
No, I just don't let people freak out when you start making fun of God.
Like, because I'm comfortable.
All right, Bill Burr, thank you for joining us.
No, I'm down to hear you. I'm down to hear it out.
All right, no, it's just an astoundingly, like, not even dumb, just not having empathy, which is the first level of intelligence. If you can't take yourself out of yourself and look at somebody else, see their situation and hear it, that there's just a level of life and living life you're not going to get past.
That's true.
You're just not going to get past. And also, they got to stop naming stuff deliberately confusing, like white privilege.
Mm-hmm.
Every white person I knew was like, I didn't grow up rich. That's how we took that shit. I don't know why. I don't know who names the shit.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I didn't know what it meant. I was like, what are you talking about? I grew up in a duplex with fucking squirrels in the wall. So.
What would you call it?
What would I call white privilege? Mm-hmm. No, I would. Well, that's a good question. I don't know. Being white? I don't know. I'm not good at this. Like, coming up with band names and shit like that. But, like, I didn't love, like, it meant how you, like, move through the earth, through the world, right? So one of the things I've been kind of having fun with in the red states is talking about the Klan and how there's all this stuff you can't do anymore, but you can still join that group. But I go, that's a great example of white privilege. You can still join a terrorist organization as a white person and it's protected under this freedom of speech. And they start saying, well, you know, I don't want to do the whole bit because I want to flesh this thing out for but they sit there and then that's one of the most fun things about doing stand-up is going to a place like that and doing some stuff like that and getting them to hear it and then going to L.A. and kind of...
We're welcoming a new show to iHeart and the DraftKings YouTube channel. It's called Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano. It's an insider's look at the NBA and the coaches surrounding the league. Every week, the 5-time All-Star and the number one pick in the 2010 NBA Draft, John Wall, will give us his unique perspective on the hottest topics in the league and tell the best behind-the-scenes stories from his time in the NBA. CJ will be bringing his A-list comedian buddies to keep it light and fire off some hoop takes. Plus, John will be inviting current and former NBA players, friends, and teammates to join the show as well to give their unfiltered accounts of what really goes on in the league from a player's perspective. So check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, the DraftKings YouTube channel, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
State Farm Insurance gets it. Representation alone doesn't equate to authenticity. State Farm understands and wants to help protect our communities by investing in our future, building off the hard work our parents have done before us. We all are looking to create generational wealth so that our families and generations behind us have a better starting point than we did. That begins with financial literacy. State Farm helps fund programs like Project Ready, a National Urban League program committed to the educational achievement of Black and brown youth. To date, participants have been awarded over $11 million in scholarships offers as a direct result of contributions from State Farm. At Eating While Broke, we hear inspiring rags-to-riches stories on each episode from our guests, but with State Farm, you can begin to write your own success story. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities and have a long-lasting impact. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
All right, so there we were, cruising through the new open-air zoo, when I realized that the park was closing in like 15 minutes. Luckily, we were in my Nissan Rogue. With its powerful V6 turbo engine, well, we had time to see all the animals.
Whoa!
And outrun a few!
Drive the Nissan Rogue.
Don't miss the new docuseries, Black Twitter, a people's history from Onyx Collective and Hulu. Based on the Wired cover story by Jason Parham and directed by Princess Penny, executive producer of Insecure, Black Twitter, a people's history tells the story of how Black voices found a new home online and blossomed into a force for change, while laying down some hilarious tweets along the way. If you were there for Meet Me in Temecula or Thanksgiving Clapback, you need to see this series. If you weren't there, time to dive in. Watch how Black Lives Matter grew and gained force because of the voices on Black Twitter, bringing these issues to the forefront like never before. From the memes to the movements, see how this powerful community shapes culture, society, and politics. Black Twitter, a people's history, is now streaming on Hulu.
How do we level the playing field for all entrepreneurs? 55% of white businesses survive the startup phase, while only 4% of Black businesses do the same. So I want every Black entrepreneur to know about the 1 Million Black Businesses Initiative. The 1 Million Black Businesses Initiative is an award-winning program created by Shopify and Operation Hope. They're on a mission to start, grow, and scale 1 million Black businesses by 2030, driving wealth creation for the Black community. Out of 6 million employer-owned businesses in the U.S., only 2.3% have Black ownership. This program gives Black entrepreneurs tools and resources to level the playing field. From free business coaching to tailored training and an extended free Shopify trial, Shopify's made a 10-year, multi-million dollar commitment to the program, and it's working. The initiative already started, supported, and engaged with over 334,000 Black businesses, helping them operate businesses that sell anything from skateboards to coffee beans to apparel. Business owners love this program. Simone Harvin, founder of SC Creative Group, says, "The 1 million Black businesses experience for me was unlike any other program I've been a part of, primarily because it was for us and it was by us. Here at Drink Champs, we are always interacting with our listeners, many being Black entrepreneurs. Shopify is one of those platforms that empowers and emboldens entrepreneurship. So chart your own path for business success with the 1 million Black Businesses Initiative and Shopify. Bring your business to Shopify with an exclusive offer at shopify.com/BEN, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/BEN.
Doing like the same thing because they think, the people in Hollywood think that you just put a BLM sign in the window and that means, you know, you're like a saint. And it's like you haven't done anything. Mm-hmm. What you basically did was appeased your sense of responsibility. What are you talking about? I put a sign in the window. I'm on the right side of history. Or my favorite one was white people marching in BLM marches filming themselves for Instagram. Like, look what a great person I am. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, I don't know. Human beings are interesting. Mm-hmm.
Is there comedy to be found in this year's election?
I mean, the joke I've been doing, like, this election is like, you know when Hollywood makes a shitty movie? You're like, man, that movie sucked. And then 2 years later, there's like a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, they're making another one of these?
Yeah, yeah.
That's how I look at this. Yeah. I think basically, the job's not worth the headache. And I think that the House and the Senate basically voting that you can't prosecute us for insider trading, and they're all worth $20 to $40 million, and you watch CNN and Fox News, you know, who are supposed to be these journalists, just completely leave them alone. It's like, why do I want that job? I can just sit here. No one knows who I am other than in my state. Mm-hmm. I can make my $40 million, move to another state. No one knows who I am. You know,
get a boat and some coke and some whores, and I'm good, right? that's how they look at it. Mm-hmm. Like CNN and Fox, if I was running shit, CNN and Fox News would be shut down. They are anti-American. All they do every day, their business is to divide us, and then who they go after. They just go after. The reason why comedians have been getting so much shit is because we don't advertise on their network, so we're just soft targets, mm-hmm. right? That's mm-hmm. why at the beginning of the pandemic, remember that kid who... he hoorded all the hand sanitizer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
one of the greatest fucking gambles ever. Because mm-hmm. They always, SARS is coming and all of this shit. This kid said, all right, I think this stuff is real. And he had a whole garage full of hand sanitizer and he was upping the price by 100%. Mm-hmm. And seeing, they were just dragging this kid. Mm-hmm. How could you do that? And then meanwhile, like big pharmaceutical companies, it's like $460 for a leukemia pill. And that's totally fine. Mm-hmm. Why is that fine? Because they're making money off them, so mm-hmm. they're not going to, like, you know, bite the hand that feeds. So this is the shit that, like, you think about when you're alone a lot on the road, and it eventually makes you go crazy. Mm-hmm. So I don't pay attention to, like, anything. Mm-hmm. I try not to, but then when I do, it's, like, heartbreaking. Like, there's a documentary about the Ukraine that came out, won an Oscar, and I just saw the trailers. It's the most heartbreaking thing you've ever seen.
Yeah.
It's almost like ignorance is bliss, right? Like, that's what you realize, the less you know, the happier you are.
I don't know. Yeah, it's weird. It's weird. And then dumb people think they know everything.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Let me show you how this works. I got it all figured out. Yeah, so that's what I realized. Yeah, I don't know shit.
Does cancel culture scare you at all? Does it make you change your set? You see a lot of comedians change their set, change how they talk, change what they talk about.
Well, that was something that, like most movements, started with something good,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then was quickly co-opted by people with their own interest, and then it just completely lost its way. And like,
but is it good, though? Because comedians were usually the ones that
didn't care about
everything, make you laugh, you know.
But if there was people, no, the initial thing, that there's these people out there sexually abusing people, like that was good to get rid of those people. That wasn't bad. But then all of a sudden it spun into, what are you talking about in your act? You know, I worked with an actor. She got canceled for an analogy. And it was all politics. The girl on Star Wars.
I don't remember.
It was, she didn't want to get the COVID shot, and then she made some sort of Nazi Germany analogy, right?
Oh, that'll do it.
It'll do if it goes against the politics. Mm-hmm. If it went across, if she was coming the other way, then I don't think it doesn't land that way, because I got to be honest with you, like Hitler and Nazi analogies in comedy are hacky. It's forever been this guy's the next Hitler, or blah 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 blah, or something like that. So, you know, I don't know. I kind of like didn't really notice it was happening. That I was kind of on stage going like, oh, I just said that. What if somebody just takes that clip and does? I didn't realize I was doing that till I did. Dave Chappelle was doing COVID shows, mm-hmm. and I went there and nobody had a phone.
Mm-hmm.
And just the freedom of that, not like I was going to go up and say something ignorant, but just not having to worry about that when they were really kind of coming for people. Because I think it's like died down. Mm-hmm. But there was a while it just seemed like they had to throw a log on the fire every month, and whether they had somebody or not. And
well, the wrong Nazi Germany Hitler reference will get you in any era. Mm.
It depends on your intent. Mm-hmm. I did Nazi jokes when I was in Germany, and they were dying laughing because it was just like,
one. We'll edit it.
What was it?
Oh, my goodness.
I was just talking about all their accomplishments. I go, you know what's amazing about you guys? You know, all the accomplishments you made, you know, with the automobile, you know, weaponry, audio tape. I just was listing all their accomplishments. I go, and then you just pick one wrong guy and it all goes to hell. And I just started talking about,
it's true.
Yeah. Because, and then they filmed it, so they can't refute it. Oh, that was a joke I was doing. Yeah. How Germany, they actually have shame for what they did. And it's not because they're better white people. It's because they're oppressed people. One, they have to acknowledge it.
Denazification, though, that's what that was.
Yeah,
it was them having shame for what they did, and you know, cleaning everything up.
I find neo Nazis are fascinating to me because, like, they're all like the support the troops people, and they're like neo-Nazis. And it's like, well, you know, the troops were fighting the Nazis. Like, just how all of that gets blurred after time. It's weird.
Nah, that one little piece you just said, neo-Nazis are fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Clip that. Throw it on Twitter.
Oh, yeah, there it is.
You'll have a field day.
I find them intriguing.
How big of a deal is it now for a comedian to have a special?
Yeah, I still think it's to have a good one.
Yeah.
If you have a whatever one, it's, I don't know what it's going to do for you, but I'm old school. I still like, I'm like one of those, you know, guys now in your business, they just make singles and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So that's starting to become that, like, have a special, chop it up. That's what the younger kids are doing. I'm still making albums. So I don't know if that's stupid or whatever, but that's how I do it. But I'm also of the belief that, like, as long as you're doing quality, people are going to come and see you.
Yeah, and staying consistent.
This feels like a comedy TED Talk.
Mm.
These are very in-depth questions.
Our listeners want to know.
I'm enjoying it.
And I was performing at Fenway Park.
Oh. That was one of those things that was so big. Like, I don't think I even mentally dealt it with it until, like, 2 years after I did it.
35,000 people.
Yeah, something like that. I felt like I was in Led Zeppelin. They had a police escort. We drove into the thing. You know what's good is I was there for a week because I got family up there, so I always go back in the summer. And
you got a family up there?
I have family.
Oh,
like relatives.
Say,
relatives. No.
I've lived a lot of lives.
I have a family.
It's a waitress early on in my career. We're in a good place now. I was walking around town and people were like, hey, man, you know, good luck on the show, you know, blah, blah. So I kind of felt like the city was behind me, which was another thing to, like, have to, like, think about. So, yeah, I went up there, and what I didn't realize is, like, they've so perfected the sound and the screens and everything. It was just like this giant comedy club. And you're always killing me. People kept going, like, just make sure you take it all in. When you're up there, just make sure, you know, you take a moment for yourself. It's like, this is comedy. I can't do that. The second I take a moment for myself, I'm immediately bombing. So what I kept doing was, during bigger laughs, was just looking out over home plate where it said Fenway Park. And it was mind-blowing. And, yeah, and then they let us hang up in right field smoking cigars. Mm-hmm. And my family, we used to always get tickets, the blue seats, up in right field. So it was kind of up there. It was really, that was something. So that was a one-time only. Because they're like, you want to do it again? It's like, no, I don't think there's any point to go back.
A lot of requests for tickets?
From people? You know, it wasn't that bad. It wasn't that bad. You know what was nerve-wracking, though? Was my high school reunion also was there.
No.
So they just decided to go to the show and that. And it's just like, that's just like a weird thing where, like, when I meet people from high school, like, you know, I had a really cool class. So, like, I'm still the person I was and so are they. It's just I'm doing this weird thing. So that was kind of, I had to block that out a little bit, right? It'd be like, you know, all those girls you were afraid to talk to. You go back to being like, you know, little Billy redheaded kid in like ninth grade. So I had to, like, okay, I gotta block this shit out and do my job.
You gonna stunt on him a little bit?
Nah. My time to do that, I blew it and I just accepted. I took the loss and I kept moving forward. I don't go back.
Yeah.
No.
You married, right?
Yeah.
To a black woman, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
How does that happen?
I'm saying a white guy from
Massachusetts. Well, I watched, like, you know, I watched Different Strokes growing up. And I had a crush on Janet Jackson.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Where'd you meet her?
First time I met her, I was with her dad, who was booking the Apollo. So I was doing Showtime at the Apollo, and she was standing out back.
Oh, she's black.
So I
watched Dad back with the Apollo.
Standing out back?
They never had any light-skinned black people at the Apollo. It was, my wife is gorgeous. She's gorgeous. So that was one thing. But I was coming up the back stairs and someone was getting booed. And I just remember thinking, like, why am I doing this? I didn't need to do this. This all started with, like, that Patrice shit where he was always, you know, fucking with you. So he was like, you'd have a good set. And he would just, and then he started talking about Talent Will's room around the corner, saying, like, you know, there's a bunch of comics over there that are 10 times funnier than all you white guys and da 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 da. And, you know, so it kind of felt like, all right, He was like, I just won a championship. And somebody's saying, no, there's some guys across the way that could kick your ass. They're not allowed in the league. So it's like, all right, I got to go play them. So I started doing those rooms. And then that led. And then I was thinking, like, well, this would be great. I'll do the black rooms. I'll also do the white rooms. And then I can get that, draw that crowd that I heard on those Richard Pryor albums. Mm-hmm. Didn't happen. but I ended up doing the Apollo. And that's where I met her. But I met her again on Tough Crowd. Mm-hmm. She was doing Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn, and we kind of hit it off. And I remember I just kept asking her out, and she just kept being a jerk. And right as I was, typical woman, right? Mm-hmm. The second I was like, you know what, the hell with her. Hell with her. Ended up running into her, and then all of a sudden she was like really nice. And we were hanging out. Oh, my God, this guy was cock-blocking me so bad that night on such an epic level.
You don't blame him, obviously.
No, it's because, no, no. Why? What do you mean?
I mean, because she's so beautiful that you understand why he would come.
No, that's not why he was doing. Okay, I get it. No, you don't have all the information.
Okay, give me the information.
Is, this guy's advocating cock blockers. It's like, how did you get that chair advocating that shit? No, he was doing it because he was miserable in his own relationship. So, like, he saw me, like, and it was like, you know, it was like fireworks. Like, we just, like, I mean. She,
love at first sight, basically.
I've only met two people that had like a vibe like her in my life. And the first one was a dude. He was just, so that wasn't happening.
Wasn't your type?
No, he was like, no, just walked in the room, you know, and you just knew the person was coming in the room. She has that vibe, right? So,
hold on, you got to clear that up. I want to be clear about that. You didn't date the guy or nothing.
No.
I'm just going to make sure.
Is it the first one?
When are black people going to let go of this homophobia? You always got to check. Like, what are you doing?
I'm for the story.
You have manicured eyebrows. Like, I'm fucking going to sit here and act like you're all good over there. Like, you don't swing a leg over the fence every once in a while. Like, no, hey, wait a minute. Look at you. You got fucking sandals on and white socks. You look like you just came from a steam room.
John Travolta.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I just mean, like I always paid attention to energy because my energy was terrible. Mm-hmm. I was, like, all introverted and blah, 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 blah. So I was fascinated with people that were just free. Mm-hmm. So that's what I meant.
Gotcha.
Okay? We're going to go back to sucking dick for a show again? This guy's a one-trick pony over here. So we go to, like, hang out, right? Uh-huh. No, so we're, like, vibing and everything. And I literally had to say to the dude, he was like a chick. I had to be like, hey, man, sorry I'm not paying attention to you. That's all the fuck he was. I was just like, you know, I'm hitting it off with him, man. I think this is going all right, right? So the end of the night comes, the end of the stand-up show, and he just comes walking over. He goes, you guys want to go get something to eat, right? And he invites her and everybody. Now I'm at this fucking table, and there was, like, you know, 10 other people there. And he's all the way down the end, and he's still, like, yelling down shit, trying to interrupt any of my talking to her. I mean, so long ago. I just remember one point the check came, and I didn't have any money. So I said, just give me the cash. I'll put it on my card. He's like, oh, he's just trying to get the miles. Like, that's how he was doing it, right?
Hating hard.
So everybody goes to leave, and now it's just, oh, no. It was the middle of the dinner, right? Or whatever the fuck we were doing. The cock block dinner, right? And I finally just look at her. I just give up, right? Because he won't shut the fuck up. And I finally just looked at her. I go, can I at least split a cab with you home? So she does that female thing. Why do you want to split a cab with me? And I just said, fuck it, right? I was just thinking. I go, because I want to kiss you.
Wow.
Right?
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Right.
So she put her head down and smiled. And I was like, I got her. Fuck this guy. So yeah. I let him do all his bullshit. Everybody leaves except for him. Me and who's going to become my future wife. And he literally goes, Nia, he goes, where do you live? Do you live uptown? And she goes, yeah, I live uptown. I go, oh, I live it too. He goes, you want to split a cab? He's trying to leave with her. And she goes, no, I'm taking a ride home. I'm riding home with Bill. Hey. And he's going like, oh, no, but I live up. He was so in his shit. He was so in his shit. Like, he didn't. She just said, I'm not going to say his name. She went, so-and-so, I'm splitting a cab with Bill. And I didn't have to say shit. I just stood there, and then he left, and it was funny.
And the rest is history.
I don't talk to him for 4 days, and he calls me up. He's like, hey, what's going on? I'm like, nothing. What's up? He's like, what? You're not going to – you didn't call me because you thought I was cock-blocking you the other night? And I'm like, you were. He goes, no, I wasn't. I'm like, why did you bring it up? So that was the end of that friendship.
And then you married her.
You know, I just don't have time. I don't have time for that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And plus, it was also kind of teetering anyways, you know?
It was obvious, too. It was like, mm-hmm. Yeah. What?
You know, your woman failed the WNBA joke is one of the greatest social commentaries ever.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm saying yes.
I appreciate that.
How did you get to that conclusion?
I was watching ESPN, mm-hmm. and they were blaming, they were talking about, like, female sports not getting money and stuff mm-hmm. like that and mm-hmm. all of that. And, like, he's just being an entertainment. It's like mm-hmm. you have to put asses in the seats, and that's what brings the money in. So there was a point where, you know, professional football wasn't doing as well as college football. Mm-hmm. And these guys just kept working it and working it till it became like what it was. And, you know, there's more women than there are men. So, like, this is not on us mm-hmm. that women's mm-hmm. sports – or at the very least, aren't being supported.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not being supported because you guys aren't showing up. So that was the seed of the bit. And I always forget my material. I forget
you,
how
you
it ended
pointed
up going.
To what actually is successful that women support.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
Reality TV.
Yeah, which is a bunch of women yelling at each other.
Yes. Yeah.
And fighting. And
yeah.
Screaming.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Throwing juice and drinks and water.
Yeah, my wife likes those shows.
Have you seen the Texas, the former Texans funny that plays for the Steelers now, Cameron Johnson? And the headline says, Steelers signed Bill Burr lookalike.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that guy. That's scary.
Yeah.
That's scary. Yeah, I concur. That guy does definitely look like me. Would have been cooler if he was a quarterback.
But that shows how popular you are, though.
Correct. Oh, yeah, I guess so. I don't think of any of that shit.
Really?
Yeah, no. That's the end of you.
That's the end of you.
You start walking around these... I don't know. I actually kind of appreciate people that feel that way about themselves, and also I don't understand it.
But I mean, when you look at
those people do that with their shirt blowing in front of a fan in front of their own audience, that shit is hilarious to me.
I don't think you can go that far, but when you think about your humble beginnings...
You got the sandals on. I could see you doing that. Blowing your hoodie around. I'm just going to do it to you before you do it to me.
Yeah.
How many times have you washed that sweatshirt, by the way? That
looks new.
Is it?
Yeah.
It looks like a white guy's sweatshirt. You threw it in with the towels or something. The bleach. Oh, okay. Oh, it's tie-dye.
Yeah. But when you think about your humble beginnings, and then you think about Fenway Park, like you got to take that in a little bit. It's like, I came a long way, at least.
I did. But, like, I'm too afraid to.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what it is. I'm too afraid to look at what I'm doing in situations like that because I need to perform. So if I get all into the, you know, start thinking of the magnitude of something. I just literally saw Kevin Hart's picture on the door, man. It's one of my favorite people in the business.
Yeah, Kevin bought, he used to buy us chairs. So that's why we have him sitting in that chair. Because he bought, for the old studio, he bought all the chairs.
He's one of my favorite people.
Great guy.
All I do. Our whole relationship is just giving each other shit. I don't think I've ever had... actual conversation. Anyway, I don't think of stuff like that. So I minimize.
Yeah.
So because I had horrible anxiety when I started out. So I had to figure out how to get the only way I could figure out how to get it past it was to look at the stuff that I was doing and act like it wasn't a big deal. It's just a job. They come in here, they get sitters and pay, you know, money to come here. I come here, I make them laugh. They leave, hopefully they come back. And I just sort of reduce it to that. And then, I don't know, then I come on a show like this and you start bringing stuff up. And that's when I think that's when I first start thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Look at me, I'm getting uncomfortable now. Look at that.
Yeah, you're ready to go.
No, I'm not ready. Talking about that shit.
Mm-hmm.
That all comes back to like, just like... I don't know, this weird, like, low self-esteem and then also, like, not accepting compliments. I haven't figured that part of me out.
Imposter syndrome?
Oh, my God, 100%.
Yeah. 100%.
100%. Yeah. First time, I always, like, that's the thought that I, every time I get off stage, my thought is, did I make them laugh enough that they're going to come back?
Mm.
And I Club Soda Kenny, I always, like, he, like, reassures me.
Club Soda Candy?
Club Soda Kenny is my, Club Soda Candy.
What'd you say?
Kenny.
Same. Kenny. Oh.
Kenny.
Oh.
See, now I'm suspicious of you. Mm. Now you're talking about sweets.
Crazy.
I'm just doing it back to you. Club Soda Kenny, legendary
former police officer, tour manager, and security guy. I made a short film with him.
Okay.
I got to put it up on your website. So he's the guy when I get off stage. He's, you know, works with Dice. He's worked with everybody. And so he knows. And he's also, you know, he's a cop, Jersey guy. You know, he talks like this, like straight shooter. He's not going to be like, no, that was a good one. That was good, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, if I get the pat on the back, I know I had a good one. So, yeah, that is my thought. I don't walk off stage, you know. Oh, God, I'm not going to use that reference. That'll start some shit. I don't walk off stage thinking I'm the shit. I walk off stage thinking I hope that was good enough that they come back. So.
Well, that was crazy because I'm literally still starstruck. Just like, remember when I just walked past the room and I was like, oh, shit, Bill Burr, how you doing? And he was just looking like, hey, what's up? Like, not at all like, oh, yeah, you know, I am that guy. You know, it was just real, real, real cool. And the first time you made me laugh was Racial Drafts, the Dave Chappelle skit that you did.
Were you three years old?
When it came out, but I watched it because I was a big fan of Chappelle's show. And then every special.
That was one of the coolest things.
Yeah.
First really cool thing that I ever got on where it was like I got this experience. It was like Beatlemania. Mm. And I only did like. Most of your listeners are probably like, who the hell were you on that? First of all, I had hair, and I only did like, you know, four or five sketches.
But he was a commentator.
Yeah, so I remember I was at this thing, Bonnaroo. You guys ever heard of Bonnaroo?
Yeah.
Oh, you have? All right, okay. So Bonnaroo is like this sort of, you know, this music festival in Nashville. It was one of the early years of it. It was a lot of jam bands. It was some really, like, earthy, smelly white people sort of out in a field type of thing. Not a city kid vibe. So it was pretty white. Not country white, but damn close.
Right.
And the lights went down, and I was seeing like this band. What the hell were they called? Praxis. Like Brain was on drums. Bernie Worrell. It was sort of this offshoot band. And the lights went down, and there was like 10,000 people in this tent. And the lights went down, and they were waiting for the band. And I just heard this dude just go, what? And then somebody else on the other side yelled, yeah. And then somebody else yelled, okay. Dude, I got like goosebumps. Mm. And it was like right when it was, I think it was right after Rick James' sketch had already like blown up.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw like how big this show was on. Like I couldn't believe it. And there was like comedians were telling me, going, dude, that show you're on is fucking blowing up. I just did a college gig, and like, say it came on at like 10 o'clock or something like that on Comedy Central, and their show was at 9:30. Like, they would be doing a show, trying to do an hour at 10 o'clock, like 5 or 10, half the crowd would just get up and leave. And he'd be like, you know, thinking, what did I say? Well, we're going to go watch the Chappelle show. I don't know if anything gets that big again with all of this media. But it was like, when everybody brings up, you know, the Rick James one and all of that. I will tell you this. The Law and Order sketch that I was in, the first cut of that, that I think Comedy Central thought was too dark. Oh, my God. It was like a fucking Oscar-winning movie because it was hilarious. And then it was like when the white dude was in prison in the end, the way they did it, and they cut to Dave laughing on the golf course, it wasn't funny.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, this is what you fuckers do to us. It was like, wow. Sound like Comedy Central. Like, oh, you know, we think there's a different ending.
They like it. Oh, shit.
Bring it a little bit. But that was another thing, too. Mm. I remember they used to edit it right up the street from where I was living. And I remember Neil Brennan going, you gotta come see this shit. And I got to see them, the Rick James sketch before anybody else. And I remember laughing my ass off, and that just became a point I stopped laughing, and I was just like, this is like, I've never seen anything like this in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was probably the first, kind of still, like one of the coolest things I got to be on. I met Charlie Murphy.
Charlie Murphy, rest in peace.
Yeah, rest his soul.
Mm-hmm. He's up there, too. We got him up there. He's up there in the corner.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Oh, man, the stories that went with that guy.
Yeah.
He had, oh my God, his stories. He had endless. Sure he told this story one time, and it was all stuff from the 80s. It would be so like, yo, I was at this party. It was me, Sugar Ray Leonard, and Punky Brewster. Right. And just going like, what party is this? Right? It was just all these like 80s icons, right? Then he was talking about Sugar Ray Leonard being drunk, talking about how quickly he could throw punches at your ribs and not hit you. And he said that these white guys were letting him do it. He was drunk and he kept hitting them and they would like fold in half and he was crying, laughing, telling him. And I was going, why the fuck would they do it? I don't know. That's the nicer one I can tell. So
that's the funny thing about Chappelle. When you look at Chappelle now, you rewatch it, you'll see you. You'll mm-hmm. see Joe Rogan. Mm-hmm. You'll see Neil Brennan. You'll see all of these people who have gone on to be, you know, icons in their own right now.
Yeah.
Dave gave me one of the greatest pep talks I ever got. Like, it's funny because I'm older than Dave, but Dave started so young. I always look at him like an older brother, right? And I was doing some shit at the Cellar, you know, and I got off stage and he was sitting on the stairs. Fortunately, I didn't know he was there. I would, at that point in my career, would have been like intimidated, somebody that big watching me. And I remember him telling me, he's like, man, your point of view was so dope, man. And he goes, it's gonna take you a lot longer to get there, but when you do, you're gonna hit hard. And I fucking held on to that for like 7 years on the road, going, Dave thinks I'm funny.
That's dope.
Yeah.
He was right.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Definitely is.
Bill fucking Burr, man.
Thank you for joining us.
All right. Thank you for having me. You guys were nice. Everybody got me all nervous.
Why?
Like, you guys are
going to... Let's not go why.
You know why.
It ain't over yet, so just leave it.
I got to be honest with you. I listened to one clip, and I shut it off after 8 seconds. You.
What clip was it?
Somebody said something like, well, you know, sometimes I... Whatever the hell he was talking about, and I just hear you go, why would you do that? Just going like, oh, shit, is it going to be this?
No, because Larry King always says the best question to ask is why. Because people say it, and I really do be curious. I'm like, well, why? Why is always the best question.
Isn't that just
that's,
your
that's,
why?
That's a better, yeah, it's a better why. Your why wasn't, that wasn't the read.
go back and watch some of the other shit.
It was like the subtext was, why the fuck would you do that?
Well, it's the same
Sounds
thing.
Sounds like him.
Depends.
No,
depends
it isn't.
But now,
well, I had a good time.
Well, thank you. You
hey, there's my insecurity. I hope you have me back.
You love to know that. There's a lot of people I know that hold you in very, very high regard.
Yeah.
Like young comedians, older comedians, like Pete Davidson always talks about you all the time. Ricky Gervais. Like,
oh, yeah. Pete, I remember. Pete was another guy. He had that vibe. He was just memorable. I met him. He was like 12, 13 years old, already as tall as me. And I remember years later, he started doing Staley 4 years later. He goes, I don't know if you remember. I remember. I said, Atlantic City. You were standing there with your mom. So, all right. How many times are we going to wrap this up?
That's it.
I think
that's
it's
it.
Done.
Okay.
That's
it.
All right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate what you
it's
said.
It's Bill Burr.
All right. Thank you.
It's the Breakfast Club. Good morning.
Wake that ass up early in the morning.
The Breakfast Club.
Black Tech Green Money isn't just about telling the stories of successful black entrepreneurs. It's also about giving actionable and wealth-building strategies that help you protect the future of our communities. That's why we're pleased to be supported by State Farm Insurance. State Farm also believes that we must invest in our communities to achieve economic growth by sponsoring programs like the AXO, which rewards high school students for their academic achievements. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Don't miss the new docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History from Onyx Collective and Hulu. Based on the Wired cover story by Jason Parham and directed by Princess Penny, executive producer of Insecure, Black Twitter, A People's History tells the story of how black voices found a new home online and blossomed into a force for change, while laying down some hilarious tweets along the way. If you were there for Meet Me in Temecula or Thanksgiving Clapback, you need to see this series. If you weren't there, time to dive in. Watch how Black Lives Matter grew and gained force because of the voices on Black Twitter, bringing these issues to the forefront like never before. From the memes to the movements, see how this powerful community shapes culture, society, and politics. Black Twitter, A People's History, is now streaming on Hulu.
If you're looking for the most epic place on Earth, let's start at the base of a massive waterfall.
Then trek through the thick jungle. Then climb to the peak of a snowy mountaintop. Then once you get there, keep going. Because with intelligent 4x4 and 7 drive modes and a Nissan Pathfinder, the search is the real adventure.
Available feature. Intelligent 4x4 cannot prevent collisions or provide enhanced traction in all conditions. Always monitor traffic and weather conditions.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment,
Oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at CedarPoint.com.